Well, we're doing a one-off lesson as Hank is out traveling down in Florida doing some corporate training. And we are, I thought it'd be fun, at least for me, to do a brief lesson on an event called the Afscheiding in the Netherlands in 1834. It has a lot to do, there's a lot of overlap with American Presbyterian history, if not directly, certainly thematically. So this isn't just an historical curiosity. We will have some application and some experiential more type questions here at the end, but we'll get through a theological or historical lesson to begin with. I think it'll pique your interest. I didn't know much about this until a few months ago when I was doing more study for various things relative to Mid-America Reform Seminary. And in addition to some lectures I gave on Cornelius Van Til regarding his involvement in the Presbyterian conflict in the early 20th century. When he was writing back to the Netherlands in 1936, he referenced the Afscheiding as a historical similarity, an historical event that had a lot to do with what was going on here in America during the Presbyterian conflict. So, there's reasons for that, and that really got me curious as to why Van Til thought that the secession of 1834 in the Netherlands was applicable to American Presbyterianism in 1936, the year that the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was formed. We're going to try to get to an answer to that question, but to do so, we're going to go through the historical lesson to begin with. If you flip over and look at the timeline on the back, you'll see my scrawls on a bunch of the sheets. I didn't have time to correct all this stuff and reprint copies, but I was in a bit of a rush, and this is what happens sometimes. So there's some corrections here to the dates. You'll see all of this now should be all correct. The one weird one is I put a little asterisk next to the Afscheiding October 12th, 1834. There's some debate about when the Afscheiding officially took place because the historical events might have happened on one day. The official document that declared the secession was dated a different day, and then there was an original copy of it or a formal copy of it that has an even different day on it. So it's kind of like the Declaration of Independence technically happened on the 3rd of July, but it was published and delivered on the 4th of July. So, you know, what's Independence Day? I guess it depends on how you look at it. We celebrate the 4th of July, but, you know, they technically declared their independence, I believe, on the 3rd. So you get a little bit of sneak there. The date with after the Afscheiding, 1869, there were two groups of the church that broke off in 1834, two different secession groups. Eventually, those came around to unite and to form a new denomination in 1869. We're not going to get into those details, but just keep all this stuff, the dates and whatnot, with a grain of salt. I know you guys you're not going to lose any sleep over this, but I just wanted to let you know that I've checked some of that stuff and tried to make some corrections. So with that, let's begin. I might be a little note heavy today. I apologize for that. I'm not Dutch. This isn't in my blood, but I have great affinity to this. And although I'm kind of new to this topic, it certainly intrigues me. But I can't teach this with my eyes closed the way I can maybe some Presbyterian history. So bear with me if I'm a little wooden and reading a little bit this morning. I hope it's still interesting. So the Afscheiding, again, it's not German. Germans would say Afscheiding. It's Dutch, so it's Afscheiding. We even had a professor once, we recorded a lesson at Reformed Forum, and forever now emblazoned in this audio and video is the Afscheiding pronunciation, which makes me cringe, and I'm embarrassed for my Dutch brothers and sisters, and that we would let such a thing happen. But I probably wasn't sitting in the classroom at the time it happened and couldn't stop and correct it and say, do it again, then we'll edit this. But maybe in the future I'll use artificial intelligence to change his words, which actually you could do quite easily. But the Afscheiding was a secession of 1834. It really represents a pivotal moment in the history of the Dutch Reformed Church, which is marked by a profound struggle for doctrinal purity and ecclesiastical autonomy. This upheaval is not an isolated incident, though. We can't see this as some historical thing that just happened out of the blue, but it really emerged. It did kind of emerge spontaneously, but as with any historical event, there are reasons for it. It emerged from a rich and a complex theological landscape that had been evolving for centuries, really. But at the heart of it, in the early 19th century, there was a brewing tension theologically between different camps. On one side were followers of a man named Gispertus Fucius. Now, yes, that's a difficult one. It looks like Vocius or Vucius or whatever. There's even PhDs in theology, I've heard probably 56 different pronunciations of this. But the guys that I would trust the most, guys that have Latin training and actually like read and understand this, they mostly pronounce it in the ballpark of Fucius. This is weird and complex because these two camps, they have kind of differing views on several different items, but they don't, in my mind, don't logically line up. Let me explain. Fucius, the followers of him, advocated for simplicity and a sobriety of life, yet they adopted a more speculative approach in theology. Those, to me, don't seem like they would naturally go together. You see, like, they're very conservative socially. You'd probably be more restrained and conservative theologically. As far as I could tell in my research, this is how this plays out. But opposing them were the followers of Johannes Coxaeus. He's written a really important two-volume set. I don't know if it was originally two volumes, but he wrote a significant work on covenant theology, and it's a really important early work on developing a Reformed federalism. He promoted more latitude in doctrine and conduct under the guise of a certain type of scriptural interpretation. But this theological difference between these two groups is one factor that set the stage for deeper conflicts within the church. But there were others, perhaps more significant and more drastic, that were from outside the Reformed tradition that complicated this landscape. If you know anything about the history of Western philosophy, or even just kind of vaguely know some things, the philosophies of René Descartes and Spinoza began to creep into the church, leading many towards different theologies, including Arminianism, which was a theological stance that very clearly contradicted key Reformed doctrines. And this shift was not merely academic, but it had a profound implications on the everyday faith and the practice of church members. So outside philosophies were affecting the church as well. But then amidst that turmoil, there was yet another distinct group that advocated for experiential piety. What one professor down at Mid-America might say, like belly rubbing and foot gazing, spiritual introspection, like maybe to an unhealthy degree. They trace their roots to pre-Reformation traditions, and figures involved in this were folks like Jean Labadie, Jacobus Coleman, and Wilhelmus Abrakel. Abrakel has a very key Reformed doctrine set as well. He wrote a lot of theology, and it's very pietistic. So the group out in Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary and the Heritage Netherlands Reforms guys out in Grand Rapids, they're a lot more in line with this camp, which is not a bad camp, but they have kind of tried to shed some of the not so good stuff of this group while retaining the good stuff. But if you're ever getting things from Reformation Heritage books or figures like Joel Beakey, like they're very much, this is why they like the Puritans so much from England and Ireland and Wales and Scotland, because there's a lot of overlap between the way the Puritans wrote and thought and felt along with the pietistic strand of theofskiding. So if you've ever wondered why that is, why these Dutch guys love the Puritans so much, it's that. It's that reason. And that was new to me just in the last 6 months. Ryan, you have anything to add to that? I don't know, like just present day socially? It's interesting to see these different camps. Please.
Mm-hmm. Line of thinking. I think it's called the, it's not Netherlands Reformed.
Mm-hmm.
It could be Free Reformed in Canada, Free Reformed churches, and they emphasize realized that you had to have a kind of experience before
yes.
you could confess your faith and take the Lord's Supper.
Right.
As a young person. Not each time, but like
right.
once when you were young, you would have to have that.
I want to get to that toward the end. That's an excellent point. If I get through all this material, and I'll probably trim a lot of it so that we can get to that point. But there's some important comparisons with the Great Awakening, or as what Daryl Hart likes to say, the Pretty Good Awakening. And then the Second Great Awakening. But they're the bad side of that, there's a lot of good that happened. Praise the Lord for his work amongst the churches. But there's a lot of loosey-goosey church stuff going on. And also an overemphasis, I think an unhealthy emphasis on feelings and emotion. Like, I'm all for religious affections. Like, the word of the Lord should affect you. Like, we don't want to be stone cold and, as some would say for Presbyterians, a frozen chosen, right? But we should have a warmth of heart and religious affections and talk about those things and try to fan those religious affections into flame. And I'm using that phrase because it's a little more theologically tethered than just your feelings. You know, we're not classic liberals that loved feelings, but they were divorced from theological truth. Gefühl, you know, these German mystics and folks like Schleiermacher, all into that kind of stuff. The word of the Lord and Christianity is, Boston? As Boston would say, Matt would know, more than a feeling. Right? Christianity is more than a feeling. I don't know how Marianne factors into this as she walks away, but certainly Descartes and Spinoza and Wilhelmus Abraco are involved. But anyway, the point I was trying to make is in the Great Awakening, you know, if you couldn't point to a moment in your life in which you had a distinct sense of a personal spiritual conversion, then they would question or even say, you're not Christian. You know, you have to have a very overt, recognizable, pinpointable spiritual moment that the Spirit changes you, which for a lot of folks who grow up in the covenant household, you might never know a day in which you were away from the Lord. Like, you've always known the Lord from the first moment you were conscious. Praise be to God for that. But folks who are much more pietistic or in line with the Pretty Good Awakening would certainly kind of discount that type of religious experience and question whether you're actually a Christian. So we want to have a more holistic and covenantal understanding of things without divorcing our religious life from the effects of Christ upon our hearts. Okay, so let's just be, we can have both. It doesn't have to be one or the other, is the point. There are other factors involved here in the background of the offsciding, though. There also was government intervention. This is applicable today to a degree, perhaps. But the government's increasing intervention in church matters added another layer of complexity. And by the late 17th century, state influence over the church was very palpable, culminating in a significant restructuring of the church under King William I after his return from exile. I don't have time to get into all the reasons why he was exiled in the first place. He had to leave, and he settled in Berlin, Prussia at the time, and then eventually came back. I don't know that history that well, but I also don't have time to discuss it. So if we'd like to learn more about King William, we can do that in the future. Regardless, when he came back to Netherlands, he instituted a bunch of church reforms because the church was under control of the state to a degree, and that really ticked people off. His efforts really to merge, what he tried to do is he tried to merge the Lutheran and the Reformed churches, and he introduced a new controversial Psalter, which showcased a misunderstanding of Reformed doctrine and piety. And this all demonstrated that the king, who really seemed indifferent to the church's doctrinal foundations, that all of these actions were perceived as overreach, exacerbating growing discontent among the faithful. He stepped outside of his bounds. And then into that intricate and fraught environment stepped a man named Hendrik de Cock, a relatively unknown figure to begin with, but one who would become the catalyst of the offsciding itself. He's kind of the lightning bolt figure Decock's personal transformation, influenced by the writings of earlier Reformed theologians and his encounter with a group of people at his home or at his church, not his home church, the church he was serving. These people yearned for doctrinal fidelity, but all of that propelled him to the forefront of this movement, in which they sought to return to the true tenets of the Reformed faith. And he became more and more popular as a result. There truly was kind of a little reformation, a renewal, an awakening of sorts. Maybe this was the Great Awakening, but it was controversial, no doubt. And his stance against the perceived theological and spiritual laxity of the state-controlled church set him really to become at odds with the established ecclesiastical and even, to a degree, the government authorities. So that's the very high-level background. A lot of detail there, but I want to slow down and go through some of these factors now, point by point, if we will. Are there any other initial questions before we get into the first heading here? Any thoughts? Ryan?
Remind me and others, perhaps, when was the official pronunciation of the Notary of
Westminster? I think it was in the 1840s or 50s. Yeah. It's later. Right. And that's with Abraham Kuyper. And so Kuyper was more involved... that much later. It was the 80s? Yeah, Kuyper died in 1921, but I thought Kuyper came up out of there. Was it that late? Yeah, because both of these secession groups ended up merging together. Civil War-ish. I don't know, yeah. Yes? Mm-hmm. It's a state church. Mm-hmm.
And there's not another Protestant church.
There's not another Reformed church in the Netherlands, but the king wanted to unite the Lutheran and the Reformed churches together, and that's not going to fly.
The Lutheran church is a state church.
I don't know for sure. They might have multiple churches or sponsored churches under the control of or at least general oversight of the government. There's different approaches to church and state, and this is one of the important takeaways of the Aufsichtigung, is this separation of church and state, or the freedom that you have, which is why you end up with churches being called the Free Church of the Netherlands. Or we're going to see in Scotland in 1843, there was a great disruption which led to the Free Church of Scotland, which is not under government control, and patronage, which was their big beef. They couldn't decide who their pastor was. The guy, the patron who owned the land, was the guy who said, no, I want this guy, and the people had no say. That was the system. Right. So different governments have different ways of doing this. There are all sorts of different general categories. You have Erastianism. You have establishmentarianism, which would say the church and state are distinct, but the state establishes the church. A lot of the Scots are still that way. And that's kind of maybe a little bit what's in the background of the Westminster Standards, because the Westminster Assembly was called by the government. And its documents, in a sense, reflect that kind of deference. And some of that stuff got adjusted in America, because we have a different governmental system and a different view of church and state. So there are dissertations and everything you could read about, American revisions to the Westminster Standards and why. So there's all, like Ryan, like there's just bookshelves and bookshelves of stuff on this topic, right? Yeah. Church and state. Exactly. I mean, and some of this is, in-house conversations. It's not you're Reformed or not if you have this view. It's within the Reformed Church, people have different views about what the government ought to be doing, how it should relate to the church. So there's a lot there. Maybe we can have a whole class on that someday. That'd be wild. Let's look at the background here, though, the theological and political precursors to the Aufsichtigung, and get into a little bit more detail on some of these theological points. Again, there was a mix of tensions, political interventions, and then this growing hunger for a return to an authentic Reformed spirituality. The first one you should bring up is the difference, as I mentioned, between the Footsiens and the Coxaeans. There's some difference between these two groups on hermeneutics. So the Footsians, again, I'm not an expert on this, but as far as I could glean in the time I had, the Footsians adhered to a typological interpretation of the Bible, seeing the Old Testament more as a type or foreshadowing of the New Testament, had a holistic kind of view of that. The Coxaeans held to more historical grammatical interpretation of the Bible, which is not contrary to the allegorical interpretation, but they might have held more or less to, being more concerned more with the literal meaning of the text and to its historical context. So there's a grain of truth, or more than a grain of truth in both, but this perhaps is oversimplification, but there was a difference in hermeneutic between these two groups. There's also a difference in terms of approach to covenant theology. The Footsians emphasize the unity of the covenant of grace, arguing that there's only one covenant between God and humanity from the beginning of time to the end. Coxaeans, emphasize more of a difference of divine economy, that there are two covenants, the covenant of works, which was made with Adam in the Garden of Eden, and then the covenant of grace made with Abraham. But they argued that the covenant of works was conditional, while the covenant of grace is unconditional. Again, this is oversimplification because we believe in one overarching covenant from Old Testament to New, at least after the fall. But this isn't all worked out with great clarity at the time. They're figuring this out and doing exegesis and haven't had hundreds of years of writings to reflect on to come to more specific terms, which is also why, to a degree, the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms sometimes tends to be a little bit more precise on matters than the Three Forms of Unity in the Netherlands. It's not because those were worse theologians in the Netherlands or in Germany or in Switzerland or other places. It's because they're 100 years prior. So the Westminster Confession have, the divines have 100 more years of writing and reflection to work with. Their two, I believe, are harmonious, but theologically, the Westminster standards often tend to be a little bit more precise and developed. It's not a knock, it's just an historical statement. I subscribe to both of them, not, just in terms of my involvement down on Mars. And then there were some other differences between the Footsians and Coxaeans. The Footsians were generally more conservative in their theology, but they also were more inclined to compromise with the Dutch government. Or Coxaeans were generally more liberal in their theology, but more resistant to government interference, which to me doesn't make sense. It would seem like it might be the other way around, but that tends to be the tendency. But speaking more of the philosophical influences, there was a rise of rationalism, and this was a huge deal for the Dutch church. They despised rationalism. And after the Enlightenment, what you have here is this introduction of Cartesianism, or the philosophy of René Descartes, and Spinoza, Baruch Spinoza, I believe. Is that right, Ryan? I think it's Baruch is his first name. Yeah. Well, Spinoza, their philosophies within the church led to a shift towards rationalist interpretations of faith, which contrasted very sharply with traditional Reformed teachings. And this, for people that love their Bibles, was just terrible. Like, rationalism always leads to really bad stuff in church history. It could lead to even, things as bad as Socinianism, where if the Bible, they're just very overly rationalistic, you trying to explain theology like it's a math problem, I guess, is one way to think about it. Where certain things, especially transcendent things regarding God, we need to take him at his word and understand that God is incomprehensible. He's revealed himself clearly. He's revealed everything we need to know for doctrine and life. There's nothing we lack in terms of what we've been given to understand the Lord insofar as he wants us to understand him truly. Yet God is incomprehensible. And we can't stand over him as if we can have exhaustive knowledge over him and his ways and parse it all out like we could, a math problem. Just write it all out, show our work, and say this is exhaustively what this means, down to every last variable. That tended to be what rationalism strove for. Then we have Arminianism, which was a theological perspective that emphasized human free will and salvation, independent of God, downplayed the total depravity of man. And it started to gain traction as well and challenged the church's Calvinistic foundations on predestination and sovereign grace. And I mentioned a bit the external influences and experiential piety. I'll skip over that since I've already kind of alluded to those things. There was some measure of Huguenot influence and other foreign theologians who also introduced new dimensions to Dutch religious thought. And sometimes those influences conflicted with traditional Dutch theology and piety as well. And then the state affairs, where King William I, upon his return from exile, instigated significant changes in the church, trying to merge Lutheran and Reformed churches. But this new Psalter he proposed also had contributions from Mennonites as well as Arminians. So it's like we have some hymns by Fanny Crosby, but they typically get adjusted and some of the words get changed. But that upsets some people. And, you know, understandably, because she was not a Reformed person. Or some of the Wesleyan hymns can tend to be a little goofy sometimes. We might change some of those here and there insofar as we have the ability. And generally speaking, the Dutch Reformed, the people of the Afscheiding at least, were not happy with governmental overreach. This sometimes included the appointment of ministers, the imposition of new ecclesiastical structures, and it was seen as an encroachment on the church's autonomy and the church's doctrinal integrity. How would we like it if the government told us we had to whatever, celebrate, Juneteenth or something? Like, I have no argument against what's behind Juneteenth, so to speak. Let's celebrate the abolition of slavery. Great. That's a good thing. We should be happy to have abolished slavery. But it's different if the church, if the government comes in and says, thou shalt celebrate this in this way in your church and have a service devoted to this. It's a wild example. Maybe it's not that wild, but you can imagine how that would go over with Reformed churches in the United States. We would not be too pleased for the government to tell us what to do. The government has no right to do that. And we have that, thankfully, expressly protected in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. Although it gets reinterpreted by whoever's in charge. But that's another matter for another day. There's hermeneutics in politics as well, not just in theology. But these theological debates, the struggle between traditionalism and liberalism, the impact of external influences, wherever they come from, and the increasing state intervention in church matters, they all contributed to a climate that was ripe for religious reformation and renewal, which introduces the figure of Hendrik de Cock. Hendrik de Cock. This is an interesting figure, just a country pastor, country parson. Nothing remarkable about Hendrik de Cock to begin with. Although this is a remarkable to me, but it wasn't, I think, a particular to this man. But this is a guy who's a pastor in a Reformed church who has doctrinal standards. The church has expressed confessions, specifically the Canons of Dort, but also the Belgic Confession, Heidelberg Catechism. These are the doctrinal statements of the church, and the ministers are supposed to know these and subscribe to them in order to be ordained to the ministry within this ecclesiastical body. That's all a given. However, Hendrik de Cock, along with, I imagine, many others, practically had no clue about what any of this was and what it meant. A member of his church gives to him a copy of the Canons of Dort and encourages him to read it and to think about it. He reads the standards that he subscribes to, supposedly, and has a spiritual transformation. Like, he's awakened or reawakened. He basically reads what he's supposed to be teaching and then is enlightened and awakened to it, while a large amount of the rest of the state church is blind or dead to these things. So you see that there's a lot of formalism already going on in the church. They say they're Reformed. They have Reformed standards, but nobody knows them and is not abiding by them in any significant way. De Kock, because of the influence of a church member, I believe just a farmer, and this goes to show also the theological awareness of some of these farmers. I think it was even Van Til or somebody in that era remarked about how some of these Dutch farmers at the time would be plowing with Bavink. Like they'd have Bavink open and like behind their oxen and their cattle, you know, reading theology. And they did it at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, reading the Bible to their families. These people are sharp. Like these are no slouches. And it kind of puts us to shame. Because even, you know, our theologians, our ministers aren't doing as much as the farmers sometimes did in the Dutch churches. The good ones, at least. So De Kock reads the Canons of Dort, has a spiritual awakening. He goes on to kind of, I presume, ask his church member, what else do you have like this? This is amazing. And he comes across Calvin's Institutes, and he reads the Institutes of Christian Religion by John Calvin, and goes to grow and develop in his own spiritual life, have an awakening of his own religious affections. And this spreads out. He starts to preach differently with great passion. It has a huge effect on his church, which is in this small little town called Ulrum. And more people come to find out about this, and people start to flock to the church. There's an awakening. It's a kind of a true spiritual growth and awakening there. Although there are many other factors involved, and the children of the Offskeiding are not all commendable. So we can hold up De Kock as kind of this hero, and we can thank the Lord for his work in this church, but as with anything, we shouldn't, you know, look at it uncritically. So I want to temper our expectations here and not just say, well, we should just have our own Offskeiding here. Well, yes and no. There's good and there's bad. De Kock's popularity really soared in response to this, but also his opposition did as well, especially from the established church authorities. His sermons in Ulrum were attracting large crowds, but they were also attracting people from other regions, signaling a widespread desire for change. But you can imagine how the pastors in those other areas are feeling when their church members are leaving their parishes to go hear this spiritual revolutionary guy in a neighboring town, or maybe even from pretty far away. This all started to grow, the tension started to grow, and it led to a significant tipping point, and what I, in my estimation, is a pretty unwise decision by Hendrik De Kock. He shouldn't have done this, but he did it. Maybe he saw it as the lesser of two evils, but it was stupid, and it led to a major problem. It was a defining moment when some people came to De Kock, and they were from other parishes. They were members of other churches. They didn't like their pastor's preaching and teaching. They liked De Kock's. And they had children, now they were born, and they didn't want their pastor to baptize the children because they thought it would be invalid or not the best baptism. So they wanted Hendrik De Kock to baptize their children because they liked him better and liked his preaching and his ministry. Now, maybe their pastor was spiritually dead. I don't know. Like, this is kind of similar to the Donatist controversy that Augustine was dealing with, I guess, 1,400 years prior, where the question was, what happens if I'm baptized? And then the guy who baptized me turns out to be an apostate. Well, the Donatists would say, well, your baptism's invalid. But Augustine, and I think the church throughout the years, has upheld the fact that the efficacy of the sacraments does not depend on the spiritual health or piety of the person administering it. Now, we want spiritual health and piety from the people administering it, but it depends on God, and it depends on the faithful administration of that sacrament. So as long as it's administered in a true church to a degree, and it's administered rightly, then it's still valid. Now, there's different debates on what a true church is, you know, Roman Catholic baptism versus baptism in other churches. The church has had arguments, Reformed people have had arguments and still have arguments about that today. But we'll leave that to another side. The point here for De Kock is, should he baptize the children of members from other churches because they asked him to? What do you guys think? What do you think he should do or shouldn't do? Let's play both sides of this. I'd say devil's advocate, but let's leave the devil out of it.
It's like parishes where people are geographically attending the church that's like...
I don't think that was required. I don't think it was like, you know, you are not allowed to go to another church if you don't live in the parish bounds, but that's practically the case. Like, the most natural thing for you to do is go to the church in your town.
Yeah, car.
Exactly. And you're wearing clompen. Like, how far do you want to walk in those?
Yeah.
Like, yeah,
he
did.
You can put the pen where your name is written down as a member.
Yes.
Right? You would be expected to attend
exactly.
and to have your child baptized in the church where you're a member.
So
exactly.
Why aren't they changing their membership? Is it because you don't do that? Or
because it's not.
Or they wouldn't let them? I don't know. That's a great question.
Because
I don't
right
know.
Now, you would
I think
this church and baptize your baby.
Correct. Let's rewind 170 years. 100, you know, almost 90 years. We are much more portable nowadays than people used to be. And that I think there's, you know, you and I like Wendell Berry, and we think that there's a lot of bad side effects to the fact that we're so portable. Now, there's strengths because we can come to a church that, you know, aligns with our convictions most closely. But also, if there's three or four churches that align with your convictions, and you could be more fickle and say, I don't like this anymore, or I don't like what they did here, or whatever. I don't like their... the church sanctuary is too cold, so I'm going to go to this other church now. Whatever. Like, whatever it is. You know what I mean? It could be anything. I'm not passing judgment on any specific thing. But people are much more transient, portable. Back then, not so much. But I don't know if there's some specific ecclesiastical reason. There might be.
Maybe it's possible then they were just going to make the big trek just for the baptism and then continue to regularly attend the church.
That, yes, that could be a possibility, where they just wanted the baptism over there and then they'd keep... Maybe they're only going to church in Orem once a month or once a quarter or something, but... Could be. It's wild. Ryan?
Were these church services, were they outdoors? Like, I imagine these were pretty big gatherings. And, I mean, you hinted at the prophets.
I don't know. I don't think...
It could be kind of revivalistic, you know?
Oh, it definitely was.
Well, I mean, if you don't have the time to, you know, transfer your membership, be examined by the session, get to know the folks, and you just want your babies baptized, like... Slow down a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't believe they were. They might have been worshiping outside. I haven't read anything in that. You know, either the books from Mars or Brad or some of these other books. There could be some similarities there. That would be interesting to know. Did they all fit?
I'm wrong, but if he's attracted,
I know.
Movement. It's,
right.
Yeah, they're subversive to the existing. Church structure.
That's exactly the point. But let me play the other side of this for a moment. Yes, it is subversive to the existing church structure. Yes, but let's say all of, you know. Let's just for the sake of the argument say let's say these are all unregenerate ministers. It's conceivable that many of them were. Okay, and is it wrong for you? And let's just for the sake of the hypothetical argument say that church won't let you transfer. What do you do? What do you do? Well, we'll get into some of that with the Belgic Confession, Article 29. This is what happens. Many of these people are compelled now to realize, I skipped over something. De Kock gets in trouble with the church authorities. He's eventually suspended from ministry because primarily the specific tipping point is he did baptize those children, got in trouble for it. He also did not do many things according to church order. At the same time, he wasn't given recourse, much like Machen, or I should say Machen, much like De Kock, wasn't given justice and a proper way to defend himself. But in this case, I think De Kock actually did some things that were inappropriate, although in his mind, he probably thought they were spiritually justified or at least the lesser of two evils. That's my most diplomatic way to say this. But he eventually was suspended. And the punitive action of the official church, the church authorities, was perceived as unjust by his followers, and that fueled discontent, and that solidified de Kock's role as a reformer. And then in October of 1834, de Kock and his followers, they were disillusioned with the church's trajectory. They formally declared their separation in Ulrum. And this act was grounded in their belief in the need to adhere to the true teachings of the Reformed faith as enshrined in the Belgic Confession. I believe it's Article 29. The 29 is the big one, right, Ryan? I believe. It demands that every Christian has the duty to unite him or herself with the true church.
29 is the marks of the true church?
Yes.
Where it differs from the false church.
Yes, exactly. And there have been different interpretations. That's a really interesting chapter, because I would love to read a dissertation on the reception of Article 29 in Dutch churches or in continental churches throughout the ages. As some people have interpreted Article 29 of the Belgic Confession beyond, I think, what it's actually saying, and they have interpreted it in such a way that it's functionally like apostolic succession. So when immigrants move to Canada or America, they have to find the church that is in the one true branch of the family tree. So it's not enough to find a church that professes the true teachings and faith. That's not enough for some continental people. It has to believe the right things, but it also has to come from an unbroken line that is this branch of, you get what I'm saying? Like, let's say Ryan decides he's going to start a brand new church next week. Sorry, Ryan. But he breaks off and he meets at, I don't know, Arby's. And he's going to start the true Arby's church. And he confesses a very specific view of whatever, believing that it is the true thing. Now, let's say that he is actually presenting an accurate and true faith, you know, according to the three forms of unity. That's not good enough for people that read Article 29 in the sense of an apostolic succession, because he just started this church. It's not coming from a true line. Maybe I'm not saying this clearly enough. It's not enough to have the right beliefs. You have to have the right historical pedigree as well. That's a better way to put it. Yes. Not everyone reads, and most people don't read the Belgic Confession that way, but that's why I would like to read a study on this, which I don't believe exists. Because there have been people in the Dutch Reformed tradition, especially immigrants to other countries. When they show up, they have to find the church, but they're really not only looking at church websites for what do these churches believe, but they have to unite themselves with the church that has the right historical pedigree as well. That means they broke off at the right times and in the right way. So you end up sometimes with people that are making decisions based on personality. You get this a little bit with guys like Klaus Schilder and other traditions, because they're looking at these controversies in the church and making a judgment in terms of which was the faithful party. And if a new church was formed, which of these two bodies is the true church line? And then I need to unite with that one and not the other one. That's an over-interpretation of 29, but it happens. All right, that's a sidebar. But I do mean to teach that in terms of there's a real commitment among a lot of continental believers to Belgic Confession 29. That's a real serious thing. And it should be. We have an obligation to unite ourselves with the true church wherever we find ourselves. Sometimes that's hard. You know, like if I went to Antarctica, sometimes it might be hard to find a church that professes true faith and the true religion. But that might inform where you move, and that's a good thing. So let me move on and fast forward a bit to, I'll just say in terms of the legacy of the Afskeiding, we don't have time to go into the details because I want to get to our questions. But this split in 1834 And then there's another group later from Kuyper's, that Kuyper comes from, the Doliansi. They separate, and eventually both of those groups end up merging, I believe in 1869 at some point. No, that's a different group. There's all sorts of different unions, but different secession movements eventually reunite themselves. But they unite themselves and present a new view of religious liberty, that the church can exist independent of state control. Kuyper takes this another degree because he also founds the Free University of the Netherlands, Free University of Amsterdam, which also takes this to the educational sphere, which is different from the church sphere, though related to a degree, in which there's this growing movement and thought that the government doesn't, you know, has its own responsibilities that are granted to it by the Lord, and the government should be restricted to a degree and not overreach beyond its authority and beyond its sphere of influence. And the family, the church, they each have their own spheres of influence. This is a Kuyperian type understanding of sphere sovereignty. And within those spheres, there are different authorities and potentially, you know, everything's under the word of God, but there are different criteria by which you might judge and decide matters. So that's even another discussion for another day. But the offsguiding really introduced this notion, and it led to more critical thinking regarding the relationship of the church and state. It also had an influence on the promotion of doctrinal integrity and confessional fidelity, not just subscribing to standards historically, but actually believing them and requiring that ministers and members would also believe these things ex animo, from the heart, not just, yeah, sure, that looks good to me. The offsguiding also produced greater thinking about covenant theology, about sacramental practice, and a renewed interest and renewal of preaching and the thoughts about the regeneration and the free offer of the gospel. There's all sorts of things that came out of this in terms of the eventual debates that have come to a head in various ways in the continental tradition later on. Okay, we only got a couple minutes, but let me at least introduce some similarities and differences with two other big church splits roughly at the same time. The Offscheiding, 1834. Okay, 1834. The disruption of 1843, 9 years later, happened in Scotland. That was huge. Or as former president would say, huge. Huge. Never seen anything like it. So Scottish, so disruptive. This one. But it was great. Greatest split of all time. And in 1843, the Free Church of Scotland began, largely over debate over patronage. So you'd have these wealthy people who owned an estate, and there would be a church on each estate. And the patron, a lot of times, would defer to the members of that church in terms of calling their minister. Although officially, the patron had the final say. Usually wasn't a problem, but it became a problem because in one case, the patron said, no, you're going to get this guy. Maybe he was bribed. Maybe he was the nephew of a friend of his. Like, you don't, he had his own reasons, which probably weren't altogether holy and just, spiritually inclined. And the people did not want that person. And that led to a great debate and eventually a split in the church, where you end up now with the Church of Scotland and then the Free Church of Scotland. There have been other splits since. You also now have the Free Church of Scotland continuing, which is different from the Free Church of Scotland, which I guess is discontinued. I don't know. By implication. In the United States, we also have a great split in the 1830s regarding the old and the new school in the Presbyterian Church. This split also occurred over not so much issues of governmental influence, because America is a different environment, but it is similar to the disruption of the Offsguiding. because of the themes of piety, introspection, doctrinal fidelity, and the supposed contrast and distinctions or competition between being doctrinally faithful or being kind and compassionate and feelings-based. So the new school is typically viewed as theologically lax, but more open, warm, and friendly, like more interested in the Great Awakening, regardless of its theological weirdness. And the old schoolers are more interested in order, government, you know, church governmental structures, confessional fidelity, but they're caricatured as being cold and heartless. These are characters, but this is typically the difference between old and new schools. So there are similarities amongst these three splits because there's dissatisfaction with established churches. All three movements arose from dissatisfaction with the perceived failings of the established church, which include concerns about state control, not so much in the old and new school, but definitely with Scotland and Netherlands. Laxity, declining spiritual standards, and then also a formalism. There's a desire for reform among them all, and then there is a formation of new denominations, where each movement led to the Reformed churches in the Netherlands, or to the Free Church of Scotland, or a split in the United States to different groups. But there are some important differences as well. They're not all the same, and I'll skip over those just for the sake of our time. Let me conclude here with a couple pointed questions to get us to think how this affects us in the present day. But this is more wide open, but how do you think the story of the offsiding resonates even with your own life? Let me ask you this, in terms of spiritual transformation, I'll leave myself out of it because it's a little bit more complicated for the moment, but what do you think about this insistence of having a moment that you can point to in your life to demonstrate that you indeed are spiritually changed? Have you ever thought about that? Have any of you had such a moment or not? What are your thoughts regarding spiritual conversion? Yeah, Edith.
It takes the Lord gives each person a different story. Mm. So, yeah, some people have a moment like, you know, Martin Luther or other people who can point to a definite
yes.
awakening in their consciousness. But I think for a lot of people, we just grow up with hearing preaching, mm-hmm. and singing and reading the Bible. And mm-hmm. It's little by little and quiet. And I mean, if we love the Lord, we love the Lord. And
mm-hmm.
I disagree that you have to be able to point to a particular...
Yeah. That you have some sort of spiritual birthday that you can identify. That you must, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Any other comments? Yeah, Ed.
One can almost reach toward a performance type of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's you having it.
Or I walk the aisle or something like that.
Somehow by implication that mm-hmm. you brought it on.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the monergistic work of God.
Yes. And this came about a lot during the Great Awakening, the Pretty Good Awakening, or the Second Great Awakening. And also that revivalism, there was a tendency even among some to view conversion as a result of a series of steps, that you could treat it as literally a recipe, that if you did the steps correctly, you know, maybe you've all been in churches where there was an altar call and all this kind of stuff. Like you play the music a certain way, you have a certain appeal, you bring people forth with an altar call, you have a prayer. Like these are the steps that if you do them correctly, it will produce spiritual transformation. Like you're farming souls.
Or you're scheduling
appointment with the Spirit.
No, or you're scheduling awakening or movement in the Spirit.
Yeah.
It's going to happen, you know. That
right there. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like it's very mechanistic. And we're not making this up. This is stuff that's been evident and has been taught in American evangelicalism. And this is what traditional confessional Reformed churches have rejected. But it's not to say that we should then believe that faith has nothing to do with our heart. No, that it's just maybe we can't point to a moment. Pam, you had a hand raised.
I just wanted to add that even though I didn't grow up in a Christian household and was not, you know, going to church until college, or late in high school, I still had like more of a gradual, you know, I went to a Christian camp, heard the gospel, I learned the Beatitudes, but then later, you know, much later, I went to church, and then, you know, much later, this, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I can't even point to a time that was the day I became a Christian.
Yeah. So the most important thing is that we would trust in Christ, that we've repented of our sins and believed on him for our salvation. If you have received and rested in Christ alone for your salvation, if you're clinging to him and not to yourself or to anything else, that you should have the assurance of faith. And indeed, you are saved. That's what's important. You know, I don't know. I believe I was saved at a young age. I can't point to a time in which I was. I did have a very specific, you know, drastic spiritual awakening of sorts, but it was more of a repentance sense when I was in college. And I could point to a specific day when that happened. But I don't think that's when I was saved. That was just a very significant moment in my life in which the Lord called me to return to him. And sometimes I wonder, well, was that when I was saved or not? And I always come back to the answer, it doesn't matter. Like, really, who cares? In one sense, do I have to know for sure if I was absolutely saved before or after that? All I know is God's been faithful to his promises, his covenant promises in me, that he promised to me in the confession of my parents and in my baptism, and that I'm trusting in Christ alone for my salvation. Like, if I can't point to a spiritual birthday, so be it. And we shouldn't feel that we have to, or let other experiential evangelical Christians, you know, make us feel bad if we haven't, you know, or had some sort of, you know, tongue-speaking moment to prove it. Yeah.
But the decision was God's. It was
yes.
Before.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Precisely. Right. Well, I kept this a little bit over. Maybe we can come back to this, slow down a bit, and do more in a future week. But we'll get back to the Heidelberg Catechism. So now we're back to studying the Heidelberg Catechism. You'll have a little bit of more historical moment behind it, understanding that it's significant and important, and you'll feel a little bit more connected to our Reformed brothers and sisters. Let's pray.